The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. And can you hear me okay? Am I loud enough for everyone? So, one of the great tasks of a human life, one of the great tasks of anyone on a spiritual journey, is to come to terms with fear, with their fear. And I suspect that any spiritual journey that doesn't frighten people isn't worth its salt. So sooner or later, for all the inspiration and joy and beauty that spiritual paths can offer, they offer also offer us a chance to meet ourselves. And when we meet ourselves in a very deep way, there's a number of things that can happen. One of them is that we discover that we have a lot of fear, anxiety, worry, apprehension of various kinds. And most people have some. It can be a small degree or a great degree. But whatever degree it's there, sooner or later, it comes to the surface. And the nature of certainly mindfulness practice, the path of mindfulness, is to bring what's inside of us to the surface so we can work through it and be free. And so if there's fear, sooner or later it has to be met. And then also, the Buddhist path of mindfulness also has to do with overcoming our attachments, the ways that we cling or resist. And one of the things that we come up against when we are attached and looking to let go of our attachment is our fears. Our fears of letting go of some of the most precious attachments we have. One of the precious attachments for many peoples has to do around the whole cluster of issues of self-identity, who they are, how they want to be seen, where they belong in society, how they think they need to be to present themselves to themselves in the world. So this attachment to self-image is a very important one. And so the idea of letting go of that can be quite frightening for people. So one way or the other, I think sooner or later we confront fear. It's a good thing to do because it's a common phenomenon in our society. And it's used by politicians and other people to motivate people to vote and to do all kinds of things. And sometimes fear is used, fearful stories, events are used to get people mobilized and engaged, sometimes in ways that may be not so healthy. Being afraid of the other people. So coming to terms with fear, to look at fear. There's a children's story that has been told by Christopher Titmus, and it goes like this, that at dusk one evening, the children of the village went to play in the forest. And then as it got darker and darker at some point, a monster came out. And the monster was big. It had big, bloody, blood-dripping fangs, long, razor-sharp, knife-like claws, and red eyes. And the kids saw this monster. They'd never seen something like this before, and so they got frightened and they ran. And as they ran, they could hear its loud steps pounding on the ground, catching up to them, and they got more afraid. And every time they looked back to see this monster chasing them, the monster was bigger. It had grown bigger and bigger. Finally, one of the little girls in the village stopped, turned around to look at this monster that was growing bigger and bigger. And when she stopped to look at it, the monster stopped also. And then she started walking towards the monster, and the monster started to shrink. And the other kids then noticed, so they slowed down and turned around, stopped, and they also started walking back towards the monster. And pretty soon the monster was so small it could hold it in their hand. And pretty soon it went poof and disappeared. So this is a story of a fear-eating monster. it's frightening, but it gets bigger the more it gets to nourished by fear. And so this is a story of many people's what fear is, that the very act of being afraid sometimes strengthens something, makes it worse, makes it bigger for us. Because unless it's a mountain lion that's jumping at you, most people, their anxiety or their worry has to do not about what's immediately in front of them, but about their imagination, what's going to happen, what they think is going to happen. And what we think is going to happen is part of the imaginary world. I have been afraid many, 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 many times of what was going to happen. And eventually, it happened so many times, eventually I discovered that my track record at predicting the future was abysmal. And that helped to loosen the grip of the worry I had. I was going to go to this thing, I was going to do that thing, I was going to stand in front of these people and say something and give a talk or whatever I had to do. That I noticed, because I'm a slow learner, I don't know how many 10,000 times I had to kind of see that, it didn't really turn out the way my imagination had planned it or anticipated. And so then my belief in my imagination, my belief in my projected thoughts started to decrease. So part of the turning towards our fear is so we can understand it, is we start understanding the stories, the beliefs, the ideas, the thoughts that sometimes generating it. Sometimes those thoughts and beliefs are quite compelling, as is the classic Chinese story of the Chinese artist, one of the great artists of China, who was painting a tiger, and he stepped back to look at his painting, and it was so realistic he got afraid and ran away. So we are artists in our minds, and we can spin these amazing stories, and then we step back or we kind of take the big picture, and they're frightening, what we come up with. Frightened of all kinds of things. It makes us frightened of the future, frightened of change, frightened if things don't change, frightened of solitude, frightened of too many people, frightened of our security, loss of our security. They say that one of the great fears is the fear of death, the fear of loss of livelihood, the fear of losing one's mental state, mind, the fear, and then connected to this list, in Buddhism they have this list, is fear of public speaking. And so, or the other one is fear of loss of reputation. Perhaps in most people in the modern world aren't so concerned about their reputation as much as they're concerned with what people think of them. And I know that for me it was very, very important when I was younger that everyone like me. And so I was, that fear of being rejected by people, it was really being liked and fear of rejection went hand in hand. And I had to come to terms with this fear of rejection that was so powerful for me, or this desire to have everyone like me. And I would do tremendous social gymnastics to get people to like me. It was kind of a headache. Until the head hurt so much, I could see the cost it took to try to do all this. I was in a monastery, and in the monastery you get to see your behavior sometimes much more clearly. It's like your behavior stands under a magnifying glass. And I saw this tendency of mine so clearly, I saw how difficult and exhausting it was, that then I started to give up that strong drive to be like, the strong drive to be always worried about, are people going to reject me? So fear is a common phenomenon. So we stop and we look at it. And this is one of the advantages of people who learn to meditate, to learn to do mindfulness meditation in particular, because meditation is a time to stop. Stop the incessant doing and activity and spinning of the head that we have, and really taking stock, really connecting and seeing what's really here for me, here and now. Meditation, mindfulness meditation, is not meant to be a way of being still and quiet so you conform, so you become polite and nice and a good Buddhist. But rather, it's just a stop so you can be very honest with what's here and really look at it and see it directly for what it is. And if we're busy, we don't see ourselves very well. If we're running away from ourselves, we don't see ourselves very well. If we're spinning a lot of fantasies and stories, we don't see ourselves very well. And so to sit and be still, to pause the story-making mind at just enough so we can see that we're making stories, to pause enough we can let the feelings and emotions that we have catch up to us, to pause and stop so we can really be here for it. And that can be done certainly in daily meditation practice, but for people who have a lot of fear, it's really a useful thing to just do in the middle of your fear, is to stop and spend some quiet time to pause, meditate, go find an easy chair or go for a walk around the block and kind of do a walking meditation or sit there and close your eyes and then take stock. Really monitor what's really happening here. Feel and be present. So meditation is a place to stop and meet and confront the monsters. But usually, just the fact that we've stopped, it's not like the fairy tale where the kids turn around and walk back towards the monsters. I wish it was that easy. We're more afraid than those kids sometimes. But to stop and take a look, sometimes what some people have to do, depending on the strength of the fear, is they have to come to terms first, not with the fear, but with their fear of the fear, their resistance of the fear. And so to go into the fear is too much. It's too difficult, partly because of this wall of resistance and fear. What will happen? We'll blow up if we get close to that fear. And so it's very helpful sometimes to realize when you stop in meditation to be really present in a higher quality way with how you are. You don't have to jump into the middle of the fire and face the deepest demons you have or the greatest fears you have. Sometimes what's helpful is to step back and take kind of a bird's eye view of your situation, how you are, because a bird's eye view may be safe to look at it. I've counseled people who have a lot of fear, especially on retreat, where you can kind of work with the mind and have a practice. You kind of stay and focus and try to have a kind of more sustained experimentation with how to hold it in awareness. And I've worked with people whom they cannot get close to their fear whatsoever. Even just to pay attention to it in an ordinary way is too frightening, and they contract, they get very rigid, and so it's counterproductive, they panic. But what I had success sometimes doing is suggest to them that they make their mind, their awareness, really big. And I ask them sometimes, can you make it as big as this room here? And will that help? And they say, no, the fear is too frightening, even for this size of awareness. Can you make it as big as, you know, the block? And they say, well, maybe as big as the block. If I imagine myself with the awareness that big, and I'm that big, and I'm sitting here a little person in IMC, then maybe I can kind of be present for the fear or sometimes if there's a mountain across the hill, across the valley from where we're teaching, I'll say, imagine you're standing on the other side of the hill and you're looking back at yourself. Then can you look at yourself being afraid? Well, then I can. So you can use tricks of awareness, of attention, partly imagination, and to do what you can so you can kind of start facing it, but without being tripped up and triggered by it so it becomes worse. So sometimes this very broad awareness helps. Other times, especially if the fear is not so good, it's not so strong, or if the mindfulness, the concentration, or the mind is quite strong, what you can do is actually go right into the middle of it and really feel it, what it's like. And as some of you who know about mindfulness meditation, one of the really key aspects of mindfulness meditation is not the mindfulness, but rather the body fullness. So to go and feel the fear in the body. Where do you feel it? Is it in the stomach, in the chest? Is there tightening up someplace? Is you bracing yourself towards life? Are you hunkering down? Are you beginning to spin out and kind of spinning in thoughts and ideas? What happens to you when you get afraid? And where does that kind of center, the energy of that center in your body? The advantage of dropping into your body and feeling it there is a number of things. One is that the body is not a story. And so if you can feel the fear in the body, it can start to help to separate you from the story-making mind, which might be generating and perpetuating the fear that you have. And so if you can be present for the fear in the body, it sometimes interrupts that thinking that goes on or slows it down. The other thing is the body is actually, your body, your physical body is a quite a wise place. And as you tend to open up to it and feel what's there, there's something about the awareness of tension, the awareness of energy or resistance in the body tends to free something up. So it begins to unravel, begins to unfold and to move. Sometimes it's very clear, it relaxes. And probably some of you, or all of you, I hope, have had the experience of simply noticing that you're tense, it relaxes. You know, you don't have to even think, I want to relax, I should relax now. Just simply noticing that you're tense, certain kinds of tension, you just kind of, oh, okay, I can relax now. So that's one of the directions. So sometimes it's that quick, and sometimes it takes a while. You hold the tension in your awareness, and then you hold and be present and breathe and be there, and then slowly something can release and let go. Something begins to feel safe. Something begins to feel met and seen. And feeling safe and met and seen really supports what's in there in the inner life. And then it can be helpful to reframe your understanding of the fear. Because sometimes the fear of the fear, the anxiety around the fear, the resistance to the fear, the anger about the fear, the shame about the fear, all these things, makes the whole situation much worse. And so reframing it, understanding it in a new way. And here's a beautiful story that I think can reframe fear for people. And I heard this from Jack Kornfield. And some of it I read when I was a child in the newspapers. Read it in Los Angeles Times growing up. And during World War II, there were the Japanese were in the Philippines fighting the war. And they sent some of their soldiers into the jungles and said, you go in there and fight the war until we come and get you. And the war ended and no one came and got them. They forgot, or just they were distracted, or they were dead. And so no one went and got them. And so they, being dutiful soldiers, they stayed in the jungle for decades, some of them, in a sense, fighting World War II. I don't think they were actually fighting, they were just surviving, kind of managing there, stealing chickens from the farmers and stuff. And I remember reading this in the paper in the 1960s, you know, 20 years after World War II, 25 years, they were still fighting one or two of these soldiers. So it seems that what happened was that when the Japanese government or the people discovered there was still the soldier in the jungles fighting World War II in 1965, they would take the most senior military officer out of retirement, Japanese military officer, put on his best military uniform, and he'd go into the jungles in the Philippines and where the soldier was supposed to be, and he'd call out in Japanese, come out, come out. And the soldier would come out, and the first thing the general would do was he would bow deeply down to the soldier and say, thank you. Thank you for the service you've done, you know, your country. Thank you, thank you. And I'm here to bring you back. And then they'd bring him on the boat to ship him back to Japan to treat him like a hero. And then thanking him for his service. And then just before getting off the boat, once more the officer would bow down deeply and say, thank you, thank you, thank you for your service. And then he would say quietly, and by the way, the war is over. So some of you, I'm confident, the wars you're fighting are long over. But have you thanked your fear? I know that I hear stories about people growing up as when they were children, and their situation was really difficult. Maybe they had an angry alcoholic parent, and every time that alcoholic father came home, things were dangerous in the house. They would hit them and beat them and yell, and so they were afraid. And that fear protected them, because that fear kept them. They would go to the room or hide under the bed or go out into the woods and climb up in a tree. They would do various things, you know, because of that fear. Maybe that fear was the only thing that allowed them to cope in maybe an impossible situation. And so it was kind of wise and protective to do it. But then they grow up, and that fear has become habitual. it's become conditioning that they carry with them. And so maybe the parents even long dead, or they've left home a long time ago. And in a sense, the psyche is still fighting that war, carries that fear with them and along with them. And so when people come as adults and begin facing this and dealing with it, some people can be ashamed of it. Some people feel like it's their enemy, a problem. Some people feel that they'll be a better person if they just get rid of it. They hide it. There's many ways in which people relate to it, or just runs them in some way. But they probably never said thank you to it. And so to reframe it, look at it a different way and say, this would probably had a really good use at some point. I was a child, and I couldn't find any other way to cope. That was my way to manage. I needed this. It protected me. And say thank you. Thank you for the service. Thank you for the important thing that you did. And then after you bow deeply, then you say quietly to it, and by the way, the war is over. It's been over for a while. So sometimes that can reframe it, the situation. But it doesn't help so much when you think the war is still going on. And so people are still fighting wars or feel like they're in wars. Things are dangerous and difficult. They feel like they need to be protected. They feel things sometimes are not safe for people in the current world that we live in. There's good reason sometimes not to feel safe. And so do we then stay afraid? Do we then justify the fear because there's not lack of safety? Do we act on the fear? Are the fear the best response we have to situations that are dangerous? Sometimes they're not. Or sometimes the fear is a good response, but if the fear gets the upper hand, the situation can get deteriorate quite quickly, or we get paralyzed, and we don't know how to act, or we do things we'd rather not do. So even if fear seemingly is justified because of a dangerous situation, are there other ways of responding to the situation besides being afraid? Are there wiser ways of responding? And this is where I think something like meditation can help, mindfulness can help, because if we learn how to thaw the fear, if we learn how to relax the fear, if we learn how to find short periods of time every day to have a high quality experience of being fearless, which is what meditation can do. Hopefully you choose a time and place to meditate and you reflect, right here and now, in this present moment, I'm safe. I've locked my door, I've locked my bedroom, I'm meditating in my closet, I've locked my closet. whatever it takes, right now, nothing can happen. And so, because you're confident that it's basically a safe place, perhaps then you can let go of the fear. Be willing to put it aside. Be willing to relax, to soften, to stop the bracing. And so in learning that skill, learning that ability, and doing it over and over again every day when you meditate, begins kind of developing the capacity to let go, the capacity to relax, the capacity to not always be afraid. And so it might start in small, kind of less dangerous situations, but then rather than staying afraid, maybe you have the ability then to relax and be fearless in the situation, or be courageous in the situation, or be wise, or be kind, or be friendly, something like that. The kind of children's story that I tell my kids when they're growing up is a story of the monster that comes, the terrible, red-eyed monster. Same story, right? The kind of monster. And rather than just, I don't tell a story of the kids walking toward the monster, but of embracing the monster or kissing the monster, loving the monster, and the monster becomes your friend. And so it still works to this day because my 10-year-old son practices Aikido. So sometimes at home, I attack him. in slow motion. And his favorite response to me is he doesn't really do the Aikido kind of defense. He moves, steps into me and kisses me. and I give up. And so this idea, so maybe there are all kinds of responses that are useful. Rather than fear sometimes, to have that ability not to be afraid. I've told a story many years ago. I've heard it many years ago, but it inspired me, the story of Norman Fisher, who's a Zen teacher in the Bay Area. Simple story that he was parking in a parking lot, and there weren't any parking, hardly any parking spaces left. And so he pulled in, so there was one spot left, and he pulled into it, not seeing that someone else was waiting to get into it. Now, you don't do that right there. He was waiting for a car. The car was leaving. He pulled into it, and the car that was waiting first, you know, didn't get in. So the person was furious. The person jumped out of the car and was yelling at Norman, you know, how could you do that? And Norman stood there. I mean, you could get afraid, right? But he stood there, and he said calmly to him, and he said something like, you're having a hard day, aren't you? And the guy relaxed and said, yes. So you have to say that. Yeah, hopefully he had the intuition to know it was the right thing to say at that moment. At that moment. But a Buddhist teacher, been practicing for a long time, probably had a sense this is what was useful. I don't know how the story ended, but but I know that part of the story. Or I'll tell you a story that I was in. I was on Hayton Laguna in San Francisco, and it was kind of back then I was living there, and it was kind of a dangerous neighborhood. And there was, middle of the day one day, this car came careening down the hill and screeched to a halt in the middle of the intersection. And out of the back seat tumbled this woman. And out of the two front seats jumped out these men running after this woman. And so this didn't look good. So I ran up into the intersection and stood between the woman and these two big guys. They were really big. And I'm not known for my fighting prowess. But I stood there, and they started walking towards me. And when they stepped towards me, I stepped away. I stepped back. Not away, but I stepped back. You know, it was like this dance, you know. I stepped back, and they took a step forward, I stepped back. You know. And then that was the extent of what I could do. And then this other guy came up from the sidewalk and walked over. And he looked at these two big guys and he said, you know, if I was in the situation of these two women, I would have wanted somebody to step in to ask what was going on. And they calmed down. Everyone calmed down. And then the whole situation worked itself out. So was he fearless? Did he step forward, that guy, in spite of his fear? I was a little bit fearless, but I didn't know what to say. I just kept stepping back. So there are times when fear is a reasonable emotion to feel. It protects us, tells us to pay attention. But can we take the lesson that fear gives us, evaluate the situation, relax the fear, so that we can think more clearly and have access to other forms of wisdom in other ways rather than freezing. And so this is where I think meditation helps a lot. Learn to let go, learn to relax, learn ourselves really well inside and out. So in situations we really need to in life, we can be wise about our fear. We can learn from it, learn the right approach, learn to relax, not to relax and then just be rolled over by someone, but learn to relax so we can deal with the situation in a wiser way. It's very, most people in our society, I think, well, and I shouldn't say this at all, but, so fear. Fear is an important thing. So I started this talk by saying that, that sooner or later, anyone on a good spiritual path needs to confront and meet their fear. So for you, I don't know if that's tonight or tomorrow or in a year or when it is, but when it comes that you notice that you're afraid, please don't be so afraid of your fear. Or if you're afraid of your fear, don't be afraid of your fear of your fear. It's really okay. It's not easy This world that we live in is not easy. It's not easy to have the conditioning and the situations that we grew up with and the difficulties that we have. And so to have a lot of respect for the fear, for your reaction, how you are, and to approach it with yourself with compassion, with care, with wisdom, not with a sledgehammer, not with embarrassment, not with shame, these things, but to with a lot of respect and even appreciation for how your system operates and how it responds, so that you can turn around and meet it, meet your monsters. Be quiet, be still, and face them and be present. Learn from them. Try to understand the mechanisms, the processes that operate when you're afraid. Fear is not a unitary, singular thing. It's a composite thing made up of many things. And so when we stop and look, we begin teasing apart and seeing all the different elements that make up fear. And then we can learn not to be afraid. In Buddhism, and then I'll stop, in Buddhism there's an idea that fear is a certain kind of aversion. So rather than anger being directed externally, like attack something, even yourself, fear is a kind of aversion that pulls back and cowers and gets tight. So it's not only you're working with fear, working through fear when you face fear, but I think you also work through aversion and anger and these kinds of things that are so closely related. So we have 10 minutes, and I would appreciate hearing some of your questions, comments, concerns, and fears. In that case, I'll ask you a question, if you're willing. How about if, could different ones of you name either something you're afraid of or something you know someone else is afraid of? And we won't have to know which one it is. And
I'll go back to the original one, which is, you know, I was an engineer. I don't work anymore, but I've always felt that I would do my job best because I feared to fail, you know, so I would be very diligent about looking for possibilities of failure in my work. And that's what your talk tonight brought to me was a memory of that. Motivation that pretty much I carried through my whole career as an engineer. So I can see that there are probably situations where that fear caused problems. But I guess I still feel like I had some benefit from it as well. So I was curious if you had
I think it could well be that you had benefit from it. But if you, but the thing about facing fear and questioning it is questioning some of the beliefs we have about it. So sometimes we will justify it because there is some benefit that comes from it. Maybe you're a better engineer, you have less problems and things because you did that. However, are there other ways to accomplish the same thing? And I've known people who have been meticulously diligent without being afraid. And so you know, there are other motivations, other ways of getting yourself to be diligent and that don't have the same toll on you personally than the fear does.
Yeah. I mean, I noticed that like, I count Donna for Shiloh, and I just come, you know, I always do with a complete fear that when I'm done counting up all this cash, it somehow comes out to be a different number from what I wrote down on the spreadsheet. So it's like... Yeah, I mean, if I can find a better way to approach that, then, yeah.
So since that's a Buddhist group, I would encourage you that's a safe place to experiment with other ways of doing it. See if you can find other ways of checking, double-checking, triple-checking, that don't entail fear.
The issue I'm dealing with is a very good friend who suffers from an anxiety disorder and has taken medication from time to time, is seeing a professional about it. And I find it difficult at times to be supportive. Mm. I've known this person long enough to know that when I speak, I have to give the end of the story at the beginning because otherwise it generates anxiety.
Mm.
And I know that I have to intervene at times when things just seem overwhelming. Helped him move recently because he couldn't do it. That type of thing. I'm struggling, though, in the area of when to push versus when to just let things go. And I just don't have any clear sense about how to do the next right thing.
If the person, the person's working with a therapist and taking medication, doing their best work, in some ways it sounds like the person's trying to deal with this, that maybe it's not your role to push. And sometimes pushing, having people judge, knowing that other people are judging you and criticizing you and or saying you're not quite, you're not good enough, is just makes the whole thing worse. One of the thought exercises I do sometimes when I meet with people one-on-one, and it's is they're dealing with something like anxiety or fear, is I ask them if a 3 or 4 year old child came into the room who was just as frightened as you are, what would you do for the child? And generally, they'll intuitively know. You hug the child, you tell the child it's okay, they're safe. You don't try to rationalize with the child because they're too young for that. Just try to make them safe and be okay. And so they get a sense from the child how to do it. And then with that as their reference point, encourage people to do that for themselves. Because without that kind of accepting sense of safety, something inside stays wound up. The last thing you want to do with a little child is somehow indicate that there's something wrong with you being afraid. Come over here, I'm going to fix you. because you're not supposed to be afraid. So I'd be very careful with someone who has an anxiety disorder and consider that maybe they just need a lot of acceptance and a lot of safety. And your job is not to push, but to hopefully the professional they're seeing is the one who helps them. If they need to push and face their fear, that's the job of the professional.
Your comment to him reminds me of a fear that's consuming me of alcoholism in a son figure in my life, and that hearing you say, well, the judgmental part may not, or criticizing someone else like that may not be of benefit, and that just increases the fear. And I noticed that the fear of what I can't control is really a big fear.
Yeah. I mean, there's a good reason. I mean, I don't know how serious the alcoholism is for this person, but they can go, it can spiral downwards in terrible ways. And I know that I don't know about this person, but I know that when other people judge them negatively, which is so easy to do, I mean, even just saying, this is terrible, you're ruining your life, can just make it worse sometimes for people. So how the art is to show your love, your care, your compassion, your certain kind of acceptance that you're there for them, while at the same time supporting them to go in a certain direction, or sometimes if it's a family member, sometimes telling them they have to do something. Giving them ultimatums sometimes in some situations, or saying that I'm your mother, I'll support you, I'll always love you, but in order for this to kind of work here, I'll go with you to an AA meeting. We'll go together. So then you can't, rather than just simply accepting it and keep drinking or saying, yeah, I love you and I'm not going to hold it against you exactly, but you can't stay here anymore if you bring alcohol into the house. So I don't know if those kinds of ideas are meaningful for you, but the combination of both, of kind of saying what, you know, saying what the limits you have that you're going to require of the person, and showing that you also at the same time have a lot of love and care. That's the art.
Well, I'm one of the people that forget to talk to their fear about the war being over. What happened to me was when I grew up, my mother was, let's say, pretty engulfing. So I have a fear of engulfment. When somebody comes emotionally too close, I go back. And, you know, it doesn't help when you grow up and you have that behavior. That was really fine while I was a kid, and she is a dangerous person, true, but once you start being an adult and have kids of your own and get married, that is really not helpful when you think about your own personal relations. And so despite the fact that I was just really lucky and, you know, I found a really good husband and it worked relatively well, when he died 2 years ago, I just went in such a tailspin again, and all my old behaviors came out. I mean, I went to, you know, to the point where I would reject anybody coming close, even, you know, my own children.
Right.
And I worked through with two therapists, one for post-traumatic stress disorder, and it was exactly about this, you know, that you say, hey, you're actually not 5 years old or you're not 10 years old, you just react to it as if you are. But I also, at the end of that, I took that meditation class, the mindfulness meditation class with you, and then you said, the second time you said, feel your body, and I'm like, ugh, yuck. Don't like that so much. And then the third time you said, feel your feelings and where are they in the body? And I'm like, oh, darn. Because now I needed to actually deal with that. And my therapist had asked me that question for the last 9 months. She said, where is it in the body? I was like, oh, I don't know. Couldn't point to it. And suddenly I could point to it and it was right here as if somebody would strangle me. And I was like, oh my God. And once I just could identify it. It went away. Seriously, it was gone. It was just, it just made me cry. And it was, the entire time it was exactly this, that I never said, hey, the war's over. You're not 5 years old anymore. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So maybe one, if we can be quick, we have one more. It's after 9 o'clock, so.
Hi. I'm really kind of interested and fascinated by the Dear Abby columns in the newspaper. And I noticed that at least 40-50% of the people who write in, they have a problem with dealing with somebody else and they just don't know how to approach the person and tell them, you know, knock it off, this isn't acceptable, or some kind of confrontation where there isn't any physical danger involved. It's just the act of actually confronting the person and saying, you know, this isn't right. And it just happens over and over again in this column. And I'm just wondering if you have any comments on that.
Well, one of the advantages of, one of the really important advantages of overcoming fear and not letting fear limit us, inhibit us, is it's possible to stop becoming conflict aversive. And that's a useful thing. Not that you then rush around looking for conflict to be in, but to be a conflict aversive person who doesn't face the fears in our lives, doesn't face the conflicts and the difficulties in our relationships to others and different situations, it can be dysfunctional then. And to overcome the fear of conflict, then when there is real conflict, when there is real challenges, we're willing to step into it and look at those monsters and hopefully do it in wise ways and appropriate ways, not fight, but, you know.
And, yeah, I'm kind of wondering what the fear is all about, though, when there's no physical, you know, there's nothing to really actually be afraid of. The person is not going to pull out a gun or anything like that. It's just the actual fear of just coming up against someone and saying this isn't right.
Okay, yeah, fear of being rejected, fear of being wrong, fear of being criticized, fear of being ostracized, fear of being demeaned, fear of being seen. There's been people who don't want to be seen. Fear of being abandoned, fear of being engulfed, fear of they're going to want too much from me. Fear, you know, it goes on and on. The social fears are, you know, infinite in variety. Our hearts are creative. So I hope this talk encourages you to take a second, third, and fourth, and fifth look at your fear, to stop for it and realize that there's a lot of value in stopping and getting to know it and to work with it. And it's not a mistake that you're afraid. It's just a reason to pay attention more deeply. So, thank you all.